Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Ken Burton, Project Manager for the Redwood Region Audubon Society and the chapter's North Coast Environmental Center representative. The EcoNews Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Our topic today is the Humboldt Bay Regional Invasive Spartina Eradication and Native Salt Marsh Restoration Project. A bit of a mouthful. With me in the studio is Andrea Pickart, the Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge ecologist. And joining us by phone is Joel Gerwine, Environmental Project Manager with the California State Coastal Conservancy. Welcome, Andrea and Joel.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Joel, let's start with you. First off, what briefly is the Coastal Conservancy?
The Coastal Conservancy is a state agency that helps to fund environmental protection projects and restoration of natural resources in coastal California, and also providing public access to those resources. So we protect land, we restore sensitive habitat, and we help build trails and other access infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And what is Spartina? Where did it come from? How did it get here? And why is it a problem?
Well, Spartina is a cord grass that grows in our coastal marshes. And we do have a native species of it down in the San Francisco Bay Area. But there are invasive species of it as well. And some of the most invasive species there are Spartina species. So it has been spreading in different estuaries on the West Coast. San Francisco Bay has had a serious problem with it. Up in Washington State, it's also been a major problem. And they've also dealt with it in Oregon. And, of course, in Humboldt Bay, we have dense flowered cordgrass in large populations in our marshes. And what it tends to do is to take over, basically. It establishes monocultures, big populations where Spartina is pretty much the only plant that you'll find out there. And that has an effect on the animals that are found in those environments, too. So the invertebrates that can live in the marshes and the birds that feed on them, the whole gamut of critters that depend on our marshes are affected by this loss of diversity because of Spartina.
Mm-hmm. And so there are no native Spartina in the Humboldt Bay region. So to say invasive Spartina is a bit of a redundancy.
That's right. That's right. The only species of Spartina there is in Humboldt Bay is from Argentina originally, dense-flowered cordgrass, Spartina densiflora.
Mm-hmm. But we picked it up from Chile, is that correct, where it also is considered an invasive species?
That's the theory, yeah, that it came up in the solid ballast of ships coming to Humboldt Bay to get timber to bring back down to Chile. And when they offloaded that ballast, the seeds of cordgrass came with it way back in the mid to late 1800s, probably.
Yeah, that was a pretty dark period in North American ecological history. In a lot of ways. The refuge has been experimenting for several years with various control methods on refuge lands. Andrea, tell us about those efforts and what have you found the most successful approach?
Sure, Ken. We have been experimenting for some time, and we started with really small-scale plots, and we've evolved into some mesoscale experiments. We began with the hypothesis that we could kill this plant by a combination of starving it by cutting off the leaves and preventing photosynthesis, and at the same time flooding it, because when these intertidal plants depend on the time that they're out of the water to take in oxygen and bring it back down to their roots. So that was the theory behind our first use of mowing. And during the first experiment, we used just regular corded weed eaters. But as we got into our larger experiments, we began using metal-bladed brush cutters and found that not only could we cut the tops of the plants, but actually now get into the soil and start grinding up the root crowns and some of the rhizomes. And Spartina densiflora differs from a lot of the other Spartinas in that it has a very shallow rhizome system. It's usually up in about the first 5 inches or less of the salt marsh soil, so it's actually possible to go in and grind away in the first treatment much of the rhizomes. So that's been the basic protocol we've used, and we have evolved different techniques around what to do with the above ground leaves. And what we're finding at this point, at this stage in the game, is that if we grind or cut that into a finer mulch, we can leave the debris on the marsh, and it doesn't create these big floating racks that cause impacts. Instead, it's easier, it more easily degraded, and it floats around the marsh and is distributed. So
just for the sake of those who may not know, what's the difference between roots and rhizomes?
Thank you. So a rhizome is actually an underground stem. So it's capable of, it's a means of vegetative reproduction. So the plant can reproduce using rhizomes. And this plant does use both rhizomes and seeds. It's a prolific seed producer, and those seeds float all around on the tide. So that's one of the issues that face us for regional control. But to get back to our particular project, we had funding from the Coastal Conservancy and some matching funding from Fish and Wildlife Service, and we carried out a 2-year pilot project where I'm not going to say eradicate, but we brought under control 35 acres of Spartina-dominated marsh, and that was done with great success using the manual brush cutter treatment. We found
that's been primarily on the Mad River Slough.
On the Mad River Slough. But it's been done on islands and on mainland marshes. And we were able to treat all of the 35 acres with brush cutters. And we also decided to experiment with revegetation because we weren't entirely sure whether that would be a required step. And it's also an opportunity to bring volunteers into the process, which is really important to get community buy-in. So we did some experiments with revegetation, but we actually found that the marsh recovers 100% on its own just from seeds of the native plants that will come back in and recolonize. So after, it's now been about 4 years since we started, and we're looking at this beautiful expanse of marsh. We still get seedlings every year, and that's mm-hmm. the reason we need regional eradication, because we need to cut off that seed source.
Mm-hmm. I've been out on that restoration site, and it really is gorgeous. So you guys have done a great job. Could you talk a little bit about the two sensitive plants that are a concern in Spartina-infested areas?
Sure. We have two rare salt marsh plants that are well-known. We have another one that's a little less well-known. These are both hemiparasitic plants, meaning that they are capable of photosynthesizing, getting their energy from the sun, but they also will attach to other plants and steal some of their water and sugars. So they're unusual in that life history.
And it's nice that we're concerned about them.
Yes. So we've been monitoring those plants just because they're special status plants since the 1980s on an almost annual basis. And the numbers fluctuate because they're annuals. They live in the higher marsh. And so, of course, we had concerns about the impacts of Spartina on these plants. And right now, there's an ongoing experiment that is more directly looking at the impacts to these plants. But in an indirect way, we just kept continuing our monitoring through the course of the restoration. And we saw our population numbers jump from numbers that fluctuated around, 1,000, maybe up to 2,000, to 50,000 the year after we completed restoration. So that was, I think, a post-disturbance response, and we don't expect mm-hmm. to maintain them at those high levels, but we feel confident that this treatment is good for the rare plants.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the disturbance from this eradication work, the mechanical removal of the Spartina, stimulates the dormant Spartina seeds in the seed bank. And that's where much of your regrowth is coming from.
That's what we think. And we're still continuing experiments. So for one thing, we're looking at the longevity of the seed bank of Spartina. We've shown with our experience there is a perennial seed bank. And we're now looking at how long that seed bank stays viable if you don't disturb it. But we're also looking at to what extent a mow treatment flushes out those seeds. And then under that those conditions, how long the seeds are, remain viable in the soil.
But of course, the water is moving seeds around too. And as long as there are seeds out there, this work is going to be ongoing, which leads us to the next step. This is Ken Burton, and I'm talking with Joel Gerwine and Andrea Pickart about Spartina eradication in the Humboldt Bay area. So given this persistent seed bank and seeds transported in and out by tidal action, you've seen the need for a broader scale eradication approach. And so, Joel, why don't you tell us about the plan that's in the works?
Yeah, let me, you know, before I talk about the regional plan and the works for the Humboldt Bay area, let me just mention that the point you're making about dispersal of seeds is a really important one. And it's important within Humboldt Bay, but it's also important up and down the West Coast. So I should also just mention that the effort in the Humboldt Bay area is part of a coast-wide coordinated effort to control Spartina. And this is actually something that was made a priority in an agreement between the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington State, the West Coast Governor's Agreement on Ocean Health. And they set a target date to control Spartina up and down the West Coast by the year 2018. So there was a real recognition that with the way these seeds move around, that political boundaries aren't really relevant to an invasive species like this. If we want to protect our marshes, we have to work together on that. So it is part of a coast-wide effort. But as you said, we're working on a regional plan for the Humboldt Bay region to tackle the problem in the three estuaries where Spartina is found here, and that would be Humboldt Bay, the Eel River Delta, and the Mad River Estuary. And that's a project that is underway now. The plan is being prepared by a team of H.T. Harvey & Associates, a consulting firm working with some local expert botanists as well. Annie Eicher is part of the team who's studied Spartina for many, many years. And that project is underway, and we're already also starting the analysis of what the environmental impacts of controlling Spartina would be. So we're working on environmental compliance as we work on this planning effort.
And from the West Coast the broader West Coast perspective, Humboldt Bay is really kind of considered ground zero in a lot of ways at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, the infestation of Spartina in Humboldt Bay is smaller than what they dealt with in San Francisco Bay and up in Washington State and Willapa Bay and Puget Sound up there. But those areas have already had really major efforts undertaken to control Spartina, and they've spent over $10 million in each of those areas, significantly over that amount of money. So they've invested a lot of time and effort. And Humboldt Bay, we've only recently started a large-scale effort. The refuge has undertaken that, gotten some funding to start on a large-scale basis to control Spartina. So until very recently, the Humboldt Bay population was the only invasive Spartina population on the West Coast that was large and wasn't really being addressed in any kind of coordinated way. So that made the rest of the West Coast very worried. Mm-hmm. People who are dealing with this problem felt like if nobody in Humboldt Bay takes care of it, it'll just get worse and the seeds will continue to pose a threat to disperse to the marshes where they've spent so much money and time and effort and could recolonize those areas and just make them have to start over again.
Right. So back to the environmental compliance process. Are you preparing a joint EIR-EIS on this?
Well, actually, we don't at the moment have a federal lead agency for the environmental impact statement, which would be the document to comply with NEPA, the federal statute. So what we're doing is preparing an environmental impact report, which is the document that complies with CEQA, with the California Environmental Quality Act, and we're structuring it to make it so that it will also fulfill the requirements of the federal NEPA regulation so that when we do get a federal agency that will need to be complying because they're helping fund the project or helping to undertake it, they'll be able to quickly take our EIR and adapt it for their needs.
I see. And what do you think the likely federal lead agency on this might be?
Well, it could be the Corps if we have to get a permit from them for working in the wetlands. That's a possibility. It sort of depends on what the control techniques are that are used, whether it's just manual brush cutters or possibly larger equipment that might require permitting from the Corps. Or it could be Fish and Wildlife Service, particularly if they were to provide some significant funding for the project, and they would also need to comply with NEPA in order to do that. And I should mention that in terms of the California Environmental Quality Act, you know, the Coastal Conservancy is the lead agency, but we're working closely with the Harbor District as well, and they've been a major player. We haven't really mentioned them yet in our conversation, but they've been a great partner in Humboldt Bay. They're working with the refuge very closely, the control efforts underway there, helping to coordinate those efforts, and they've been helping a lot with the mapping, and and they've indicated that they're likely to be able to help coordinate a regional effort. So we're very, very happy that they've been so willing to play a major role in this important conservation project.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't even realize that the Harbor District has a conservation division, but they do a lot of great work.
So, Ken, I realized that when I was summarizing the work on the refuge, it was really everything that we've done preliminary to a very large project that we just kicked off last summer, and Joel's alluding to, so I do want to mention that. We received $1 million grant from within the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it was based on, you know, the good performance we had in that pilot project. And the goal of this project is to bring under control all of the Spartina within the refuge boundaries. So we've jumped from 35 acres now to 300 acres. So it's really well positioned to be a demonstration project to base the regional project off of. And we have partnered with the Harbor District on this. So some of the staff people working on this are actually employees of the Harbor District, and they're doing a lot of the crew hiring, et cetera, et cetera. So that project is well underway. It's got a 2-year time frame, and we'll be learning a lot from that. That'll be applicable to the regional eradication. And that project is overseen directly by Annie Eicher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. So, Joel, would you run through the three alternatives that you expect will be in the plan?
Sure. What we're doing in the plan is to try to look at all the control methods that might be useful in dealing with Spartina and think about what the pros and cons of each control method are. And, of course, some of those control methods might be useful in some areas of the region and not in others. So, for example, one of the things the refuge has been thinking about and we are also going to look at in the plan is the use of large machinery, something like an aquatic bobcat, maybe within a kind of a rototiller attachment that could do the sort of grinding action that Andrea described more quickly and broadly than you could do it with a person wielding a handheld brush cutter. But that kind of machinery can only be used in places where you can get access, and it's probably best in a high-density, kind of large stand of Spartina. So in a place like adjacent to Eureka Slough, there's a marsh that fits that description right along 101. Other areas, handheld brush cutters might be better. And we're also going to be looking at, in the plan, the pros and cons of using herbicides to control Spartina. Imazapyr in particular is an herbicide that's been used a lot in San Francisco Bay and Willapa Bay. It's actually been the primary means of control for Spartina alterniflora, which is the main species they have in those areas. It's different species of Spartina. And so we do want to evaluate that. It could be a lot cheaper, require a lot less labor to use it. In San Francisco, they actually found that herbicide was less, it had fewer environmental impacts because it didn't require as many people to be out in the marsh as much. So there was less disturbance to sensitive wildlife because of that.
Right, which we don't have so much here.
Right. So, but to come back to your question about the alternatives, the way we're framing the alternatives for this project for the EIR is that we would either control Spartana using all the available methods. That would be alternative one. You know, that would include the potential use of herbicides, or that we would use all the available methods with the exception of herbicides. That would be our second action alternative.
And then the third alternative, of course, being no action.
Right.
This is Ken Burton, and I'm talking with Joel Gerwine and Andrea Pickart about Spartina eradication in the Humboldt Bay area. So let's stay with the herbicide issue for a moment. I know as soon as the word herbicide is mentioned around here, a lot of alarm bells start ringing. So tell us a little bit more about this particular herbicide, imazapyr, and you know its persistence in the environment, and also its documented effectiveness on this particular species of Spartina. My understanding is that densiflora is a bit more resistant to it than say alterniflora.
Yeah, that could be true. As I mentioned, they were mainly using it on a different species of Spartina than what's present in Humboldt Bay. And there did seem to be more resistance from densiflora to this particular herbicide, possibly because of the way the plant grows. The leaves tend to be kind of enrolled and tougher than the smooth cord grass, which is the main species they were dealing with in San Francisco and Willapa, so that it might not absorb the herbicide as well. Mm-hmm. But it's also possible that they had less success with it in San Francisco Bay because they were forced to apply it later in the season because they had the endangered clapper rail down there, and right. So there were limits on when they could go into the marshes to do their control work. So what we'd like to do at the Conservancy is a real small-scale experiment to compare the brush cutter method with herbicide application and see, you know, if you can apply it at the right time, how it will work. It seems to have been fairly effective in Washington State, where they have a very small infestation of densiflora and Gray's Harbor, and they've used a mixture of imazapyr and glyphosate there. Mm-hmm. But just to say a little bit more about imazapyr, it is a broad-spectrum herbicide that's fairly powerful, so it tends to, you know, in layperson's terms, it tends to kill everything, every plant that you spray it on. So obviously that's a concern. You're working out in the marsh, and there's rare plants out there, and you really want to minimize any non-target effects. The good news about it is that the studies so far have shown that it breaks down quickly when exposed to light, and that it's very water soluble. So it will be flushed out well in areas where there's good tidal access, you know, where there's good tidal influence. Any overspray you have that doesn't get absorbed by the plant would tend to get washed away quickly and then broken down by the light. There have been some concerns raised in some areas where there's less tidal flushing, or, you know, if you're going to use this next to in a riparian area, for example, that you might have problems with it persisting just because there's nothing to wash it away. And if it's staying in the groundwater, for example, it, you know, being a potent herbicide, that could give you problems with getting the native plants to grow back after you control the invasives. So, you know, that's something we want to look at again in this plan by looking at the studies that are out there. Hopefully by doing our own study, we would look at not just whether herbicides were an effective way of controlling Spartina, but whether the native plants would grow back afterwards as well as they have after mechanical control, because that's, you know, that's again something I want to emphasize. We're not just looking to get rid of something. We want to bring back the native salt marsh. And that's something the refuge has been really effective at. You know, you were saying, Ken, that you've been out to the Mad River Slough area, and it looks really beautiful now. And it's been a great thing about the project is that the native salt marsh plants come back on their own pretty much. Mm-hmm. So if the herbicides presented a problem with that, that would kind of defeat the purpose of the project. As you know, as you gave the title of the project in the beginning of the show, and it's not just Spartina eradication, but it's also native salt marsh restoration.
Yeah, and we've just got a few minutes left, but let's talk about that component. If the natives come back so well on their own, what is there for us to do? Andrea, you want to take that?
Well, they come back so well on their own, as long as we're retreating them as needed and we're continuing to take out emergence from the seed bank, etc. So, yeah, there's still a lot to do. And also, one of the things that we found in our work was that doing this restoration with the brush cutters does tend to reduce the elevation of the marsh slightly and drive the succession of the marsh to a slightly earlier successional mm-hmm. stage. So we need to monitor this over a longer period of time to really be able to say, yes, we've restored the marsh, and we need to monitor the other components, the invertebrates, et cetera, to say that we've, you know, restored the functionality of the marsh.
And if I could just restate what Andrea was just saying, you know, we have to be, the marsh does have this vitality and resilience to be able to come back after we control invasive Spartina, but we have to be careful not to be so focused on, you know, killing the invader that we burn the village in order to save it. So that's one of the great things about working with the refuge, is that Andrea and her staff have been so good at being careful and studying what they're doing and studying how the marsh responds, so that we can really feel confident that we aren't going to inadvertently screw things up somehow with changing elevations or other factors that would keep the salt marsh from healing itself.
And there still is the opportunity for public input in this process, isn't there?
Yes, that's right. We recently put out a notice of preparation for the environmental impact report from the State Coastal Conservancy, and we had asked people to provide input on the scope of the EIR and issues they were concerned about. And while the deadline for those comments, the official deadline, has passed, we're always interested in hearing people's thoughts about how to deal with this. We really want to incorporate the community's concerns and really make it a community effort. So I'm always happy to get people's comments, and find my email on the State Coastal Conservancy website. There's an announcement about this project on there, or they can call me directly at 510-286-4170. 510-286-4170.
Okay. Thank you both very much for coming in today, or for being there remotely, Joel.
Thank you, Ken.
Our pleasure.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Ken Burton, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today have been Joel Gerwine of the California Coastal Conservancy and Andrea Pickart of the Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge, and we've been talking about regional Spartina control. More information is available at the refuge's website under Invasive Species and at the Conservancy's site under Projects. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the Audio Archives page under Web Audio at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. You can find Redwood Region Audubon, the organization for which I work, at rras.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 707-826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks, as always, to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.